Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to spend the first hour of today's program having some frank discussions about things that you should be having frank discussions about, preferably with your family and loved ones. At 9:30, we'll talk about advanced directives, but we'll start the show taking on another sometimes difficult thing to talk about. The truth is that most of us have lost or will lose a loved one at some point, yet the subject of death can be so upsetting, many don't plan for it until they absolutely have to, or not at all. But with preparation and perspective, arranging a funeral can be an experience that offers support, healing, and connection. Knowing the wishes of the deceased, planning for the costs involved, and thinking about how to manage grief are all steps that can be helped by advance consideration. Today, Chris Palermo joins us to talk about these topics and more in his role as president of the Vermont Funeral Directors Association. Chris, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. And I have to say that that was a wonderful introduction because it covered a lot of good information, and hopefully we can expand on that over the next half hour.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you'd like to ask Chris a question or if you want to tell us how you address the subject with your own family, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Chris, what are the steps to planning a funeral?
Well, I think that the most important step is having a conversation prior to ever meeting with a funeral professional. It's sitting down and having a conversation about what it is that you do or do not want in terms of a funeral service and what your final disposition will be. And that's obviously not, you know, dinner table talk for many people, but it's an important part of communicating with your family so that they fully understand what it is that you desire or do not desire. So that's sort of key number one. The second piece of that is going to be covered in your second half hour today, and that's the Vermont Advance Directive. And that's really an important tool in your toolbox in terms of not only placing somebody, a designated person that you trust to make healthcare decisions in the event that you're unable to, but it also gives them the legal responsibility to take care of your death care wishes as well. And it clearly delineates for everybody what your wishes are. So that's the two steps prior to ever, sitting down with a funeral director at a time of need. You know, when we are called on a death, our first step is to communicate clearly with the family about the deceased's wishes. And I think that one of the most difficult things for us to do is to sit down at 9 o'clock in the morning with a family and say, you know, what did your grandmother, your mother, your brother, your sister express in terms of their wishes, mm-hmm. and have them say, you know, we don't know because they never wanted to talk about it.
Yeah. Do many people make arrangements for their own funeral at some point in their life?
Actually, yes. Many folks call with questions. I've been a funeral practitioner for 41 years. I owned and operated the Perkins Parker Funeral Home in Waterbury, which is just down the street from your station.
Yeah.
And, we have had over the course of many years families calling us and asking questions about how they plan services. Most funeral homes have pre-planning packets that they can offer families that run the full gamut of helping you, organize information for estates, obituaries, what it is that you do or do not want, right down into the specifics of, do you want a church service? Do you want hymns? Who do you want to have for pallbearers? All of those things. So that information is available through many funeral homes in Vermont, and it's a pre-planning packet that helps you organize and then come to us with questions and answers.
Well, let's go on the assumption first that a family hasn't had this conversation. There's no plans in place. So what happens then?
So, you know, the difficulty that you know, presents is the fact that then now you are making decisions for your family members based on, you know, what your perspective potentially is in terms of what your disposition and service thoughts are. And that's a whole level of anxiety that, you know, adds to, you know, what's already present in losing an individual in your family, you know, a loved one. So, you know, we begin the conversation about options. You know, did your family member want a traditional service with burial in the cemetery? Did your family want, you know, member want cremation or variation therein? And then we take a step-by-step approach to make sure that they are comfortable with the decisions that they make. They are comfortable with the costs related to those decisions, because we're only going to do this once, and we want to make sure that we do it to the best of our ability and that we're as inclusive as we possibly can. The pandemic has certainly made a big difference in how families approach these things.
Yeah. Now, granted, you're coming from the perspective of being the president of the Vermont Funeral Directors Association, but you've been through this quite a bit. You have some perspective on this. So can you talk about the value of funerals and the role that the ritual plays in healing for a family?
Sure. You know, we have, as being sort of creatures at the top of the food chain, we have the distinct honor of being the only species that cares for its dead. And, you know, throughout the centuries, we have ceremoniously honored through cultural beliefs those who have passed from this world and then accompanied them to their final disposition. You know, we have spent many generations and centuries comforting one another with communal support of family and friends. And that, you know, our mission is to gather together as a community, as a family, to celebrate and support the living and bring those who have passed away to their final resting place. And there's no substitute for that. And I think that the pandemic has absolutely brought to the forefront the need and necessity for that communal gathering in support of one another. There's no substitute for that. And there's a huge hole in your heart at the time that you lose someone. And part of that healing process is gathering together as family and friends in the community to honor and celebrate and grieve together that loss. And that is the integral importance of having a service and having a funeral. And it can be the range of many things. I've often said a good funeral has four components. You know, you have the deceased, you have a venue where people can gather to, as a community, to mourn that loss and celebrate that life. You have mourners who will gather together to do that. And then you have a disposition where you have some closure, where you bring the person to either the crematory or the cemetery, and then those four ingredients help you begin the healing process, which takes, you know, a community to help you through.
Chris, you've mentioned the pandemic a couple times. How sure. has that changed what people are able to do with viewings and funerals and burials over the past year?
Well, it's made a significant difference. I mean, we have been dealing with the pandemic since March 10th of 2020. As you know, the state closed down. Gatherings weren't permitted. People continued to pass away. And so it was our mission to, you know, help families get where they need to be and the dead where they need to go. Dispositions needed to continue to take place, either in the cemetery or to the crematory. But the difficulty really is the fact that, you know, yes, you can put a pause on having a service, but you can't put a pause on grief. And that has been a substantial problem for people moving forward and healing. And, over the summertime, you know, the restrictions eased up a bit. We were having services outside, which allowed for larger gatherings, though you had to wear a mask and your spatial distancing. But in the wintertime, when cemeteries close and the churches aren't open, it's just heart-wrenching having to wait to take care of a final ceremony and disposition.
Most of us wouldn't know how to begin to organize a funeral. It's not something we do often, thank goodness. But are there specific rights and protections, maybe oversight in place to help family, to help loved ones who are left to have to manage that job?
Absolutely. And that's the key role of a funeral professional. You know, we certainly will do as much or as little as a family would like us to do. We are also very sensitive to the costs related to funeral services, so we want to make sure that we help them make good decisions financially as we move forward. But funeral professionals can take care of everything that a family needs, so that the only item that they need to really focus on is the service itself and being present. We contact clergy, we take care of cemetery arrangements, we, you know, take care of writing obituary, we can place those obituaries in the paper and on the internet, we take care of ordering flowers if they would like us to, we make all kinds of arrangements for receptions and everything else that goes around that. So really, you know, funeral directors, a large part of what we do today are event coordinators, and I've often half joke that, you know, I'm not sure why it takes a year to plan a wedding, because if you handed that responsibility to a funeral director, you could probably accomplish that in about a week.
Well, there you go. You can do that as a sidelight. Chris, I was kind of lucky with my parents. My mom and dad had talked about their plans together, and so when my father passed, she knew what he wanted. And then my mother was very open about talking to the children about what she wanted and actually went about helping to plan her own funeral. But how do you get that conversation started if you do have children or parents or your spouse who aren't comfortable in discussing their death and the funeral arrangements?
Well, I think there's two options, really. I mean, there's you know, the best way, honestly, is for a family to set a time aside and say, listen, you know, these are important issues for us to consider, and we have some specific thoughts about what we want, and to have an open conversation. I mean, the other option, which oftentimes happens in my vocation, is setting an appointment with a funeral director, and rather than coming to the funeral home, have the funeral director come to their home, your home, and sit down and just have an open dialogue about options. You know, you don't have to, you know, be put on the spot to say, well, you know, what do you want? You can lay out, funeral director's very good at communicating with folks about what their options are for them to consider. You just say, you know, these are some things that you really should begin to think about. These are the tools that you can use to begin to plan these things, and we're here to answer any questions and help you get where you need to be. But, you know, honestly, communication is the key piece of this.
What are the options that people have when it comes to funerals and burials?
Well, you know, there's a lot of options. You know, the traditional funeral, where you have a visitation, a potential viewing, service in a house of worship, and then a burial in a cemetery. You know, 40 years ago when I first started my practice as a funeral director, you know, services are sometimes held at home. Visitations were held at home, and then the next day you went to the cemetery, and following that you went to the graveyard, and then following that was a reception. As time has passed over the last four decades, cremation in Vermont has become a preferred method of disposition. Memorial services have been a key part of that, so that you're not necessarily having a casket in the church or another place of worship or at the funeral home, but you have an urn. And all of the same, you know, services can be provided, you know, with just a different method of disposition. green burials today, where families have chosen to have family members remain at home, and then having burial services without a casket or embalming and such. Funeral directors can certainly assist in every fashion of, you know, those types of services. So we have a lot of tools in our toolbox to make sure that every person is an individual and is unique, and that their services can be the same way.
You mentioned costs a little earlier, Chris. What are the costs, and not necessarily specific dollar amounts, but costs that people will need to be concerned about when it comes time for the funeral and all the arrangements, et cetera?
Sure. So there's really two ways to approach this. And in the conversations that we have as funeral professionals with families, is we want to make sure that you know, the families have a budget in mind in terms of what's comfortable for them in terms of approaching services. Because the last thing that you want to see happen is for a family to take on a financial responsibility that has long-term negative effects on their well-being. Because not only do you need to deal with the death at hand now, but also you need to live with their circumstances, financial circumstances, long term. You know, for many families, you know, that are on Social Security, and you lose your spouse, you lose half of your income. And so we need to make sure that we make good conscious decisions. You know, many people have life insurance that they want to apply toward funeral expenses. Many people, you know, have set money aside either in a funeral trust or on a bank account that allows you to use that as a budget to pay for services. So I think that, you know, in the world of funerals, a traditional funeral today, with a moderately priced casket, burial vault, and cemetery, interment, can range anywhere between $8,000 and $13,000. Direct cremation services with memorial service and burial can run the gamut of anywhere between $4,000 and $6,000. So, life is about choices, and we need to make sure that, you know, we help people make good financial decisions as we walk down the path. Because at the end of the day, quite frankly, all caskets provide the same function, whether they're expensive or inexpensive. You know, what people will remember is not the urn that they chose, not the casket that they chose, but the service that they had. I mean, I've sat across the desk with many families over the years that experienced a death, prior to, and they said, well, we'd like to have the same casket that we use for our parents, but they can't remember what it was. But if you ask them something specific about the service, they can remember that. And I think that that's the key ingredient. That's what's important in what we do in our vocation.
Do funeral homes offer payment plans for these services?
I never did in my practice. We're all small businesses here in Vermont. I'm not speaking for every funeral home, but I did not do that in my practice. We obviously expend a lot of money up front for families, taking care of services, and we just didn't have the margins available to be able to do long-term financing. I can't speak for everybody, but that's not something that we offer to our funeral home.
Gotcha. Now, a lot of people who want to be cremated will also have a request as to where they'd like their remains to be kept or to be scattered. Are there state laws around those things?
In Vermont, cremation is considered final disposition. So whether you scatter ashes, keep ashes, or bury ashes, the state doesn't care. I mean, there are on certain waterways, the state, I would prefer that, you're not adding ingredients into waterways. But in terms of ground scattering, there's really no jurisdiction over that. The things that we counsel families on is, once you scatter ashes, you're never going to get those back. So that to make sure that, this is the final disposition that you really want, and that it meets everybody's needs, just want to make sure that, as they walk down the path, that's the best decision for them.
And then let's talk about the cemetery plots, for instance. You know, this is something that, you know, it might have to be made, the decision made in that week, you say, you know, after someone passes away. But is it wise to have that lined up already in advance before, you know, someone passes?
I think it makes perfect sense. And I think the more groundwork that you can do in preparation of our final demise, because honestly, none of us have ever gotten out of here alive, mm-hmm. that it makes sense to pre-plan all of those ingredients, you know, sooner than later. And honestly, I mean, cemetery plots, just like everything else in life, are never going to be less expensive. And I think that you tick that off of your stuff to do list. And it's one less item that your family may need to deal with in the chaos surrounding and all the emotions surrounding the time when someone passes away. So I think it's really inherent that cemeteries and pre-planning services all make perfect sense.
And the obituary is something that's also important to our loved one and then the families who are left here. Who should write the obituary?
Well, honestly, in my practice, again, I mean, I probably wrote 95% of the obituaries. You know, when we sit down in the arrangement process, you know, I gather all of the information that would typically be in an obituary. Now, what's really helpful, to be honest with you, is nobody knows, you know, about your life better than yourself. And, you know, when somebody takes the time to make notations or even write their own obituary is incredibly helpful because there are things that your family may not remember about what you did, organizations you were involved in, you know, many of those aspects. So, you know, although we're very deft at doing obituaries and writing them and being creative, you know, all the help that we can get to completely frame an individual's life and all of their accomplishments is greatly appreciated.
Chris Palermo is president of the Vermont Funeral Directors Association. Their website is VTFDA.org. Chris, thanks for being with us this morning.
Yep. Can I just add one thing? Do I have a moment?
Please do, yes.
I'd be glad to give you my email address for the public. So if anybody has any questions or want to continue the conversation, I'd be glad to do that. And my email address is Chris, C-H-R-I-S, and then a period, and then Palermo, my last name, P-A-L-E-R-M-O, the numeral 1, at gmail.com. And I'd be glad to communicate with anybody if you have any questions.
All right, and I'll have that as well if listeners want to contact me if they didn't get that. Thanks so much, Chris.
All right, thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, and then when we return, we're going to talk about advanced directives. And a reminder that coming up at 11 this morning, we'll bring you the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When I visit my doctor, the staff always ask if I've completed an advanced directive. This must be something important. As a matter of fact, Governor Phil Scott has declared this week Advanced Directive Awareness Week. So this is a good time to explore what they're all about and why we should consider having one. Here to help us on those topics is Cindy Bruzzese. She is the Executive Director of the Vermont Ethics Network. Cindy, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you've got a question about advanced directives or can share a story of how a family member having one was a help to you, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cindy, first of all, what is the Vermont Ethics Network?
So Vermont Ethics Network, we are a small not-for-profit organization. We're based in Montpelier, but we cover the whole state of Vermont, and actually we get calls from New York State and New Hampshire as well. We focus kind of on three general areas or topics. One is medical decision-making, which is the topic we're going to talk about today. Everything related to planning for future healthcare decisions, to the documents that you can complete, to put down in writing what matters most to you, all kinds of decisions related to current health needs, as well as and planning for end-of-life care needs. I also work with hospitals and non-hospital healthcare facilities across the state to help them recognize, manage, and ultimately prevent ethical conflicts, which are sort of inherent in the practice of clinical medicine. And then I direct the statewide task force on palliative care and pain management. So we work in all those realms, so to speak, serving Vermonters, Vermont healthcare providers, and Vermont policymakers as well.
What exactly is an advance directive?
So that's a great question. These are documents. Advance directives cover a couple of things. They cover generally, it's a legal document in Vermont and most states. It allows a person who has the ability to make decisions for themselves to think about and to document who would make decisions for them in the event that they couldn't make decisions for themselves for some reason. And not only the who, but also what those decisions should be. So it gives them an opportunity to put down in writing what matters to them, what their priorities are as they age, or maybe as an illness or disease process advances, so that people who will be called upon, if the person can't speak for themselves, will have a good sense of how to guide the healthcare team to navigate the kind of in-the-moment decisions that can come up when someone is aging or is ill.
Now, I as an individual can't assume all eventualities for what might happen to me. What kind of decisions does one have to make when completing an advance directive?
That also is a great question, and I think I've seen an evolution in my years at the Vermont Ethics Network, where we used to see people being very specific about treatments. So you'd hear or you'd look at documents and you'd see people say things like, yes, I want to have an attempt at restarting my heart if my heart were to stop. Or, no, I would not want to be hooked up to a breathing machine for an extended period of time. So we used to see documents that were quite specific to treatments, and generally really focused on end of life. And what I've seen happen over the years is that we've learned a little bit, just to what you were saying, that there is no crystal ball. There's no way to predict exactly what circumstance you'll be in. And what's actually more helpful is if you can identify circumstances or values that are important to you, like living at home, staying in your home, being able to garden, being able to recognize and communicate with your friends and family. So broader goals that we then can allow the healthcare providers and the experts with all those different tools and treatments to figure out what are the right tools and treatments that help this person achieve goals that they've identified are really important to them. So I'm really a fan of thinking more broadly about goals and values and priorities and preferences as we age that would allow someone to take that information and then apply it to whatever situation is at hand, and then let the healthcare team help that individual who's your spokesperson, your healthcare agent, sort of figure out, does this make sense to try based on what we know is important to this person? So I'm definitely leaning more towards values and goals-based kinds of documents as opposed to more specific treatment decision documents, because I think those are harder to implement.
Who should we be consulting when we're making these decisions, filling out the advance directive, and also who do we let know about our advance directive?
Yeah, so consulting with people, I mean, advance directives, at least in Vermont, and I think in most states, are really intended to be conversations that you have with the people that are your sort of circle of friends and family. I think a lot of times people think it has to be family members. It absolutely doesn't. It can be, you can appoint people who are your close friends. And ultimately, we want you to have conversations first with the people that know you well and that you trust, so that you can have that discussion and kind of talk through situations and scenarios so that they have a sense of, well, if I were in the position of needing to make decisions for you, do I know what you would say if you could say? I think if you have specific health care concerns or you're living with a chronic or life-limiting illness, it's really important to talk with your health care provider and to get a sense from them about what the future may hold for your particular illness or disease as you age and the kinds of decisions that might be likely to come up. And then to have those discussions, not just with your healthcare providers, so you have a good understanding of what's going on with your health, but then again, back to that circle of friends and family so that they have a sense of what your priorities are should something unexpected occur.
Now, I've filled it out. What do I do with it?
Yeah, once you fill it out, you have to have it signed in the presence of two witnesses, and then it's a legal document in Vermont. What you should do with it is you should make copies if you can. Certainly your healthcare provider can help you with that. And then give the copy to the person or people that you selected to be your decision makers. I always think it's a good idea to make sure you talk to the person that you're identifying as your decision maker beforehand to make sure they're willing to do it. And then they should have a copy. Any other friends and family that are likely to be around or maybe even supporting that individual or individuals in making decisions would be helpful for them to have a copy. Your doctor, the hospital where you're most likely to receive your care, and then, of course, the Vermont Advanced Directive Registry.
Now, can I make a change once I've decided on something and then circumstances changes? Do I have the opportunity to make changes to my advance directive?
We absolutely hope you will make changes to your advance directive over time. So in my little world of nirvana, where everyone would start this process when they were 18, they would at least at a minimum name a healthcare agent, that spokesperson. And then as they age, as circumstances change, even as their constellation of friends and family sort of moves around and shifts, they would be updating these documents. And in Vermont, when you make changes to your advance directive, you do have to complete a whole new document because it is a legal document that needs to be signed and witnessed. And then you would just give copies of your updated document to all the same people that you gave the first copy to. And make sure that we are trying to look at the most current document, because that's the document that will guide the care decisions if you're unable to speak for yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's the most current document that we're looking at.
Why do they need it? Why is the Vermont Ethics Network so concerned about these advance directives?
So the thing for me is that it used to be, I think, that we thought about this idea of even planning and talking about and having these conversations is something we call advanced care planning, and that's a little bit different than completing legal documents, but it's all kind of rolled together as one comprehensive process. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's really about how do we ensure that the care and treatment that we are providing as healthcare professionals, or that your healthcare professionals are providing, aligns with the care and treatment that you want. So this is an opportunity for people who in that moment don't really have the ability to speak for themselves, because normally you get to discernment what happens and doesn't happen to you because people get to make their own decisions. But if they can't speak for themselves, we need to have identified someone who can be that spokesperson, who has the legal authority to make those decisions, and who knows what that person values. That's the way we ensure that the care and treatments we are providing are in alignment with what that person wants, and that's how we give good quality person-centered care, which is really, I think, the ultimate goal.
Cindy, what happens if I don't have one completed?
Yeah, so that's actually more the case. It's more likely that we encounter a person in the hospital who can't make decisions for themselves who doesn't have any of this documentation done. We're still hovering around 30% nationally, and I think Vermont's statistics are about similar to the national averages of people that haven't done any planning. So what happens is we look to other people who seem to know you well, that are showing up at the hospital, that are clearly exhibiting care and concern for this individual, and we try to glean from them, can you tell us what this person would say? I think it's important to remember that when someone comes into the hospital who's injured or ill and can't make decisions for themselves, our first obligation is to try to restore their ability to make decisions for themselves so they can once again participate in their plan of care. So we're always trying to restore that person to a state of wellness that will allow them to guide what happens to them during that hospitalization. That's not always possible, and sometimes it takes longer than we had hoped. And so we will look to other people, and that's fine and great, and Vermont has a very open framework, if you will, for allowing other people to make decisions when an individual is not able. So we don't have, most other states have laws that say automatically if a person doesn't have the ability to make decisions and if they haven't completed one of these documents and there isn't a court-appointed guardian through the probate or family court, then it will automatically default. Decisions will automatically default to a person in that person's family, spouse, next of kin, and they usually, many of the laws outline some hierarchy and order of priority. Vermont doesn't have any such law that guides that. They have some frameworks for certain circumstances, but not for all medical decisions. So I think the nice thing about that is healthcare professionals are then able to look to people who seem to know this person the best. And generally, we do a pretty good job of working with those family members and friends to come to a place where we're making hopefully good decisions for that individual as we're trying to restore their health and wellness. But the challenge comes when, as you can imagine, all those people come together and they're not saying the same thing. They're identifying different priorities, or maybe they're identifying conflicting priorities. That's when it gets tricky because we don't have a legal decision maker and we have a group of people who clearly care about this individual who's injured or ill, but they're all saying something different. And so now we've got to try to figure out how do we try to gain consensus around what to do and hope we can get to a place of consensus while we're working to restore this person's state of health. And that's fine if that's what that individual wanted. But if that individual would have preferred not to have had a prolonged hospitalization or maybe a long time in an intensive care unit, they would have gotten a bunch of interventions that they didn't actually want. And so but we don't have any options in those circumstances. So it's really important, I think, for people to think about this in advance, to identify that decision maker so that we can do the best we can to provide the kind of care and treatment that aligns with that person's goals and values.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Rich calling from Starksboro. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Rick, and good morning to your guest. Mm-hmm. I got a question, I guess. I was listening to about the values. Suppose I added to my advanced directive that I value being totally dead. If I have some form of dementia like Alzheimer's where I don't understand any spoken words, I'm unable to articulate any kind of word, and I don't know who's around me, and I'm laying in feces and urine in a long-term care facility. It's owned by a large corporation here. The corporation's not in Vermont, but the facility's here in Vermont, and it hasn't been changed. My sheets haven't been changed for 4 days. But I value being dead under those circumstances. There's no tools or anything to get my wish on this. Is that correct?
And we do have a death with dignity law in Vermont, Cindy, but I don't know if that would apply here or not. So what are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly hope that that circumstance never happens to you or anyone else.
Especially to our fine, Rich. We don't want that to happen.
Well, it happens.
But I would say that there's a couple of things. I think usually when people are diagnosed with an illness like dementia, that's a progressive terminal illness. So it advances as the disease marches along and as people age. And so there are opportunities throughout that disease course for people to firstly do some advanced care planning, complete an advanced directive, and signal circumstances that they would find unacceptable. I think there's also something we have in Vermont called medical orders. We refer to them as DNR COLFT. So it stands for do not resuscitate. That's the DNR portion. Mm-hmm. And COLFT, clinician order for life-sustaining treatment, COLST. So there's an opportunity to engage, have a conversation, shared decision-making discussion with your clinician, so that would be a physician, nurse practitioner, or physician's assistant, to talk about the kinds of treatments that you would not find acceptable and to ensure that those aren't provided. So there are opportunities where if you don't want to be artificially fed, if you get a pneumonia, you don't want to have the pneumonia treated. So there are things that a person could forego and to allow a disease to take its natural course and to allow for a natural death. You know, I think some of the situations you've described are certainly very concerning, and I would hope that all of the facilities in Vermont are tending to people's basic care needs. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, that there's local ombudsmen that can be of assistance in trying to make sure that people are getting the basic and essential care that everyone requires and that everyone's sort of ethically entitled to have. As it comes to the Vermont's law on medical aid in dying, I think we refer to that in Vermont frequently as Act 39. We are a state that allows for a person who has the ability to make decisions for themselves to voluntarily request that a prescribing physician prescribe for them, if they are at a terminal state and they have a prognosis of 6 months or less, a medication specifically for the purpose of hastening their own death. That law, if you will, is not available to people at a time when they no longer have the capacity to make decisions for themselves. Gotcha. So for that circumstance you described about dementia, it's infrequent where a person is at the end stage of their dementia diagnosis, so meaning 6 months or less, when still have the capacity to voluntarily go through the process. So it's generally not something that people with dementia would be able to avail themselves of as an end-of-life care option.
Cindy, what if I file an advance directive in Vermont and something happens to me in another state or another country?
So another country is probably a little more challenging because, you know, I don't really have I don't really understand the laws in all the countries, but I will say that across the United States, we have very good reciprocity with people, with other states honoring documents. So, for instance, Vermont specifically wrote into our own statute that we will honor any other state's advance directive document or that medical order that I spoke about. Other states have similar orders like that we will honor those orders, assuming we have no reason to believe that they're invalid. And we have this very good reciprocity between states here, especially the ones that are bordering states, because we do see patients, you know, going to Dartmouth, which is in New Hampshire, for their health care, and they are very good at honoring and recognizing and even helping people complete Vermont advanced care planning documents. The beauty of having a registry in Vermont is that it's a web-based resource. So once a person submits their document to the registry, they will receive a wallet ID card as well as stickers that will go onto their driver's license. They can put on their driver's license or even health insurance card. That information allows the person to signal that this person has a document in the registry. And even if you're out of state, that healthcare facility could call the registry and ask to get a copy of that person's documents so that they will have the information they need to, again, make good decisions for a person while they're working to restore their health.
Cindy, we're almost out of time, so I'm probably going to ask you a big question for a very short answer. But just quickly, go through the steps of a person making an advance directive.
Okay, quickly. First and foremost, have conversations with your friends and family and the people that know you well. Identify somebody or a group of people that you think would be able to and willing to make decisions for you if you're unable. Select a form that works for you. We have a multitude of forms on the Vermont Ethics Network website. So if you're depending on where you are in the process, you can name an agent and be done. Or you could then go on to complete more information about your goals and values, have that document signed and witnessed, and then send that document to the Vermont Advance Directive Registry and give it to the people who are most likely to be involved in having to make healthcare decisions for you, and continue to have conversations about your priorities throughout your lifespan so that you can update these documents and people know what matters most to you so that healthcare providers can do the very best they can to give you the kind of care that you're seeking.
You did that brilliantly. Cindy Bruzzese is the executive director of the Vermont Ethics Network. And to learn more about advanced directives, you can visit their website, vtethicsnetwork.org. Cindy, thank you so much for this insightful information.
Thank you as well. Always a pleasure.
Okay. We're going to break now for CBS News. We'll be back to talk with national correspondent Bob Ney. And Sox fans, tune in this evening beginning at 6:10 for pregame coverage. First pitch 7:10 as the Red Sox return to Fenway to open a series against the Chicago White Sox. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings, and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and it's time to turn to national correspondent Bob Ney to get caught up on the biggest issues facing the world and the country. That's definitely going to involve J&J and the Russians. Sounds like a new, cool new band. Bob, thanks for being here.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great.
That is a good name for a band.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
I would think anything in the Russians. Bob and the Russians would be a great one right now, but... Bob, let's start off. COVID cases still rising.
Right. The total deaths worldwide are 2,979,170. Total deaths in the United States are 565,240. Now, the thing is that some states have risen, some states haven't. The number of COVID-19 deaths averaged 1,000 per day this past week, which, by the way, is still a 7% drop. So the average number of daily COVID vaccinations has risen to 3.1 million. That's a new record for the seventh straight week. So even though, you know, there's caution out there, the bottom line still remains the more, you know, vaccinations that can be gotten and also the more distancing that can be, you know, still kept intact, the better. Now, I will tell you, because I do stations across different parts of the United States, mm-hmm. The stations in Tennessee tell me it's kind of just, quote, back to normal with, you know, different concerts, people without masks. And so, I mean, what happens? I don't know.
Interesting. And what effect might we see? You know, you're talking about this very forward momentum we're getting, the effect of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine suspension right now.
Well, you know, look, people are leery of Johnson & Johnson due to the, you know, the blood clots. It's had a pause. It's had a pause in Europe also. I think it's yet to be determined. Depends what, you know, the CDC is going to say about it, the FDA. Obviously, you know, in my mind, if you're going to get a vaccine today, are you really going to, you know, when they started up, how many people would be more prone to Johnson & Johnson? I mean, I had Moderna myself, you know, mm-hmm. as a vaccine. So I think it's time will still show where we're going to be on that Johnson & Johnson. And the other thing, too, there is a statement which, ironically, my doctor told me last September. He said, by the way, you're going to have to get a yearly booster on this. And I said, really? And he said, yes, that's what he thought. And sure enough, today they were saying that if you've had the vaccinations, probably going to have to get a booster shot within a year.
Okay. Good to know. It's what we've started to suspect. And yeah, we'll just have to arrange for that in our schedules. And I think we would do that when we think of what the opposite could happen. So, all right, that's the J&J side of our band. Let's get to the Russians. Joe Biden enacted some Russian sanctions. First of all, what brought this on, and what are the sanctions?
Well, there were some announcements about, through our intel community and, you know, different parts of the world, actually, through the media, announcements about Russia, which has continued a very aggressive cyber attack situation with us and with even within our government structures. As a result, the president came out with some sanctions. Now, the sanction that didn't occur, which maybe really could have went after Putin, and I'm not sure why this wasn't in there, I guess, maybe because they want to try to talk first, our two countries, but they could have targeted the oligarchs, who are the very, very powerful, wealthy people who keep Putin in his power position. Mm-hmm. If they were targeted, it might keep Putin in line. But right now, like anything, these sanctions will do very little. Better than nothing, don't get me wrong, but they will do very little, Rick, to really do something to make Putin change behavior. I think we live in a world where tomorrow morning we could wake up, Putin has advanced into the Ukraine and China has advanced into Taiwan. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, I think, you know, everybody knows that within our military structure and within the White House. So I, I believe that President Biden's taking, Rick, a two path. One, the sanctions, but the other, he is offering to meet with Putin, which I personally don't think that anything's wrong with that myself.
Gotcha. Staying on the Russia subject, what's gone on here with Paul Manafort? What have we learned about him passing some polling data on?
Well, this is not a good story for Paul Manafort. You know, of course, you know, the president's given pardons to, you know, various people, but well, the United States just announced that they are sanctioning Konstantin Kilnick, who is a Russian-Ukrainian political consultant. Now, he was indicted in the Mueller investigation a couple of years ago. He was indicted for carrying out election influence. He's still on the hunt. You know, they're trying to see if they can find him or extradite him. And now this report, it's a Senate intel report, by the way, for the U.S. Senate, and it looked into 2016 in the election, and they are saying that Paul Manafort, previous campaign manager, as a lobbyist for the pro-Russian president of Ukraine, that he had released some information, election information, and that's, they're saying Manafort passed it over here to this individual, Kilnick, who is, again, on the hunt, on the run.
Hmm. All right. Let's,
doesn't look good for Manafort.
It, I mean, sure doesn't.
Not a good thing.
No, not at all. I want to talk about something that I think Republicans were warning ahead of the vote, the election in November, about, you know, Joe Biden wanting to expand the Supreme Court. And is there a bill now that would do that? And what's the chances of this going anywhere at all?
Well, there was a press conference, and it was led by Jerry Nadler, who is a Democratic member from New York, who's chair of Judiciary Committee, Rick, and he went to the steps of the Supreme Court with a couple of other members of the House, actually three more, and they announced they were going to do a bill to expand the court. Across the street in the Capitol, Speaker Pelosi said, we're not going to hear that bill. It's not going to have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was fascinating at the very same time the Speaker just stopped it. Now, the reason she did, she wants this commission to come out. The Biden commission will look at a lot of things. Federal lifetime appointments by judges, should we have that? Should there be an age cutoff like many states have? I mean, there's a lot of other issues. Should you expand the court from 9 to 13? So I think Speaker Pelosi just wanted to make it crystal clear that that bill that's being introduced is not going to be the vehicle for change, and they're going to see what this Biden commission will bring. I mean, we've had these before. We had the Ford Carter Commission. It had 87 recommendations. I and Steny Hoyer, he's the number two Democrat in America now in the House.
Mm-hmm.
We took those recommendations and put most of them into play into a bill called Help America Vote Act. Now, in this case, Chairman Nadler is doing the bill first. We took the commission's recommendations and put them into a bill. He's doing the bill, which means, Rick, he probably will put commission recommendations into his existing bill. You can do it either way.
All right. And one more act or bill, the Paycheck Fairness Act, love to talk to you about. I think this is not the first time this has been passed by the House, but what would it do and where might it go?
Well, it's four times, actually, the House has passed it. You're right, it's not the first time. It tries to close loopholes used by employers to pay women less than men for doing the same work, you know, equal work, equal pay. And now, with the pandemic, with COVID, we've seen that it's actually widened the disparity for women's employment and equity within the world of female workers, you know, and the World Economic Forum projects. They are saying it will take American women roughly 61 years to have economic parity with men with what they're making, which is a long, long time, you know, and that's in women in North America. So they're trying to do this. What success it'll have, I don't know. The Chamber of Commerce is going to fight it. So we've got a 50-50 Senate. I can't predict, Rick, anymore what's going to have success. If I had a direct line to Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, I might be able to answer you.
Yeah, he is the linchpin.
The decider.
He is,
yes,
the decider, right. And we've got the Derek Chauvin trial going on right now in Minneapolis, the death of George Floyd. And where will this go next week? because things could get contentious.
Yes, Chauvin declined to testify. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've done it and your listeners. If you were a juror and he's declining to testify, what would you think? I mean, you know, I always think about that. But then again, mm-hmm. you could get ripped apart on the stand anytime you do testify. So he took basically the fifth.
Right.
But the defense and the prosecution rested. They'll make their final cases Monday and the jury deliberates. Bottom line is there's three potential charges there. One of the charges could bring 15 years. You know, what does the jury do? You know, we don't know. If they find him guilty, what's the sentence going to be? I think whatever happens, you know, if it's not to satisfy, you know, some of the people that are supporting, obviously, fairness for George Floyd and what happened to him, then I think we better brace for some problems up in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Bob, I lived in Miami, Florida, when similar trials were going on and verdicts were handed down and resulting in a lot of rioting in that city, and it really tears a community apart. So,
sure does.
Yeah. National correspondent Bob Ney, as always, really appreciate you spending time with us this morning.
Well,
Thanks so much.
Rick.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
It won't be so very long before Vermonters will be able to purchase marijuana for recreational use. And that means many enterprising farmers will have to consider where they fit in the cultivation of this new cash crop. They probably could learn quite a bit from what has happened so far with pot's cannabis cousin, hemp, to see how things might shake out. And Wallace Allen covers breaking news and business stories for 7 days. And she's with us now to talk about the business of hemp in Vermont. Ann, great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Oh, and Ann, congratulations on your new gig at 7 days. Great to have you there.
It's really great.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Now, what got people all heated up to grow hemp a few years ago here in Vermont?
Well, there was a change to federal law in the end of 2018 that made it more legal for more people to grow hemp. And at the same time, there was a surge in interest in CBD, one of the products that comes from hemp. That is, the FDA has actually approved CBD for one prescription use, and then as you have probably noticed in every gas station and other store in the state and elsewhere, it is known, it is believed to have health-giving qualities. So, you know, people will spend a lot of money for CBD tinctures and food products and salves and things like that. So basically, it looked as though there was big money to be made from this crop.
Now, that market seems fairly robust. So why has there been such a bust in the hemp market here?
Well, it's an interesting story. And, in fact, 7 Days' entire issue this week is devoted to the ins and outs of cannabis, which is what the plant is called overall. We call hemp – we sort of use hemp as a shorthand for the plant that doesn't have THC, the stuff that makes you high. So as with many, many crops, what happened is everybody planted hemp in the summer of 2019, and the other end of the hemp pipeline, the end that processes it, turns it into things, and sells it, wasn't really prepared for that level of activity. And so a lot of people spent money and a ton of time and an awful lot of energy growing 5, 10, 20 acres of this stuff. And in the spring, in the fall, they found out that it was very time-consuming to harvest it. They had to find a way to dry it. And then people who had contracted to buy their crops found themselves with much too much on their hands and nobody to buy the CBD oil that came out of it. So there was a sort of a log jam in the fall with too much product.
Do we know how many people were growing hemp?
We do, because the state licensed hemp growers, and that year almost 1,000 people got a license to either grow or process hemp products in 2019. And then in 2020, you know, after there was a big crash in 2019, and a lot of people said, I'm never going to do this again. So last year, things only got worse with the pandemic. I mean, suddenly people weren't picking up their CBD products in stores and putting them in drinks and things like that. And the market took a big drop. And so this year, however, people are doing it differently, much more judiciously. They're growing much less than they did last year. And we're not seeing the out-of-state sort of speculator types from Colorado and California who came in, leased land, and planted a bunch of hemp. But we do have the same number of registrants this year as we did at this time last year, 2019, or almost the same number, just under. So a lot of people are going to be growing hemp this summer. It's just going to be a very different-looking environment.
And you mentioned we know the numbers because these farmers have to be licensed with the state. If I want to grow carrots or you want to grow Brussels sprouts, we don't necessarily have to license that with the state. So why do hemp farmers have to be licensed with the state?
That's a good question. I mean, it's not a Brussels sprout or a carrot kind of crop still. I mean, in many states, it's regulated very, very carefully. And in fact, even one of our own farmers who grew hemp, the kind that's going to make you high, in 2019, she was sending her crop to a purchaser in New York who had actually bought it, and the police seized it, thinking that it was the kind that does get you high. Mm-hmm. And she ended up losing a lot of her profit from that crop. So it's still in Vermont, it's not considered a regulated substance per se. Or I guess it is because it's regulated, but in many places it still is. So it's not going to be treated like just a regular, ordinary crop. And in fact, if your cannabis plant ends up having more THC, which is the stuff that gets you high, than it's supposed to, then suddenly you're breaking the law.
2019, 2020, really bad years for the hemp market, for CBD. Do we expect a rebound in the market in 2021?
Well, it's just everything is different now. First of all, a lot of the sort of amateurs and the first-timers and the people who were very experienced farmers but weren't experienced with hemp are not going to be it sounds like from the people I've talked to, and I've sort of talked to a lot of people, a lot of the ones who tried it out and aren't really dedicated to the industry aren't going to stay in it. However, many growers are gearing up for 2022 when the state is aiming to start allowing, the sales of recreational marijuana like they have in Massachusetts. So people are getting their greenhouses ready. They're getting their fields ready. They're, staying in the industry. And from the growers I've talked to, quite a few have said that they're getting into it this summer as a preparation for getting into it more next summer. They're just going to grow hemp this summer, but next year it's going to be the stuff with enough THC to sell as recreational cannabis.
So, yeah, they'll grow pot. And, they're hoping to roll right into the pot market probably leave hemp behind. What we've learned from hemp will it apply to the pot market? Will they have gleaned enough from growing hemp that will help them once recreational marijuana becomes legal next year?
I think one thing a lot of people learned was that if you plant a big crop, you have to find a way to harvest it and dry it and process it.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a lot of hemp plants standing in the fields and freezing that fall of 2019 because people just didn't have the capacity to harvest it. Of course, the limits for growing the stuff that becomes pot are going to be much stricter. You can't grow 20 acres of it. But from the experienced farmers I've talked to have said you wouldn't want to do that either. I mean, as with anything else, there's people in other big states that can also grow recreational cannabis, and Vermont farmers really only stand a chance of profiting from this if they can brand it as, the special high-quality stuff, the way that we do with our specialty food products.
And unlike, my carrots and your Brussels sprouts, we probably want to protect it from more than just rabbits, when we're growing cannabis that has the THC level, the pot, from intruders, right?
Do you mean the human kind of intruders?
Yes, exactly. Human intruders.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting because in some parts of the state, even now, while it's still only legal to grow two plants for your own use, there's mm-hmm. definitely a glut of dried, high-quality stuff that you can smoke. But nobody's going to it's unlikely that it's going to be worth stealing crop out in a place where there's a lot of it growing. But in Burlington and other places where people don't have lots of land and lots of growing expertise, it's still worth something and it's still valuable, especially high quality stuff with a known provenance.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of hemp was left out in the fields. Is there any danger that the state would register too many marijuana growers for the market and what the market can bear, and that we'd have, perish the thought, weed wasting out in yonder field?
Well, I don't know that they are taking that role in regulating what's going to become recreational marijuana. They're regulating all aspects of the market, but as far as I know, they haven't actually talked about controlling what happens with, sort of the way that the dairy industry is controlled. Like, I think they're leaving that to the open market to decide.
Wow.
How much is grown and how much you end up getting for your crop.
Oh, that's interesting. And I want to go back to those poor hemp growers who never got paid for their crop. Will they ever see that cash?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of them, and there's a bunch of them in the Northeast Kingdom who signed up with a Florida cable installer named Jeffrey Knight, who came up here and started a company that still exists in Winooski called Vermont CBD or CBD Vermont, and they feel that they have been ripped off by him because they were never paid. He says that his lawyer, Pietro Lin, says that the contract read clearly that they were not going to be paid unless he could find a buyer for it. And just as our story was going to press, Pietro left me a message saying that Jeffrey is still working on it, and now he thinks he has a buyer in Colorado, and that he is indeed going to ship out those people hemp, which is now all in his warehouse, and pay them for it. I relayed this to one of the growers who said something that I guess I can't say on the radio.
Other than they're not going to cash the check just yet.
They've moved on, let's put it that way.
Yeah, very interesting.
But there's a couple lawsuits out there.
Yep. All right, and we'll see if Mr. Knight ever does resurface here in Vermont from his digs in South Florida. So Ann Wallace Allen is the business writer for 7 Days. Hey, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And you can read Ann's story and find the whole edition of 7 Days devoted to cannabis online at 7daysvt.com or all over Vermont. You can find editions. They came out on Wednesday. We're going to be back after CBS News to meet a woman who runs Animal Farm in Orwell and who produces world-class butter and perfume. Very interesting. Don't forget, coming up on WDEV this afternoon, we've got Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, and then that'll be followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. A number of years ago, I got up way early and headed to Orwell, where I was greeted by a small herd of Jerseys who were about to be milked, and that rich and creamy milk was then turned into mind-blowing butter. Yes, that's a thing. More recently, I learned that this incredible butter maker has also turned her attention to perfume. Yes, as in lovely scents. I'm still trying to get good at one thing in my life. Animal Farm's Diane St. Clair is roaring through at least her second area of expertise. Diane is here with us, and it's great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint. Welcome.
Thank you, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Diane a question or if you've tried her butter or perfume, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Diane, describe Animal Farm for us.
Animal Farm is a beautiful place in Orwell, Vermont. We are in the beautiful Champlain Valley, and we are surrounded mostly by open fields. And we are also the home right now to 11 registered Jersey cows and some of their offspring. We milk sort of the old-fashioned way. We milk into buckets and carry the bucket to the bulk tank and cool the milk. And then we hand separate our cream every day, twice a day. And twice a week, we process that beautiful golden cream into butter.
That's so great. When I was there, I think you had 7 jerseys. You're up to 11 now. Why jerseys, though?
Jerseys are really unique cows. They are the butter cow. They are originally from the Isle of Jersey, along with Guernsey cows. And these two breeds probably have the highest butter fat in their milk of any bovines. And the wonderful thing about them, too, is that when they're out on pasture, which on my farm is any time between now, if it would stop raining, and just get warm, and October, that they process the carotene in grass differently than other cows, and it gives their cream a sort of golden hue and also makes the butter very bright yellow, kind of like a dandelion yellow, mm-hmm. which just makes it that much more appetizing, because when you see something or you smell something, that kind of primes your mouth for what's coming.
Yeah, I get it. When and why, Diane, did you start producing butter?
I started in 2000. Well, I actually started making it in 1999 when I got my farm. And then I quickly learned that you can't sell butter or any process dairy product legally unless you get a license to do so from the state of Vermont. So I started working on getting my plant together to make it legal, my creamery. And I decided to make butter because at the time there were a lot of artisan cheese makers. Cheese was kind of the focus of the value-added products in dairy. But I saw a real gap in the market for farmstead butter. Vermont Butter and Cheese at the time, now Vermont Creamery, was making a cultured butter, but they didn't have their own cows. So I decided that I would be able to control the product a lot more if I actually had my own herd and used my own milk. And then I did make a cultured butter along with that.
And how long did it take you to get it to where you said, okay, that's my butter. That is just right.
It's always a work in progress, Rick. I mean, the challenge of milking your own cows is that, and having them on pasture, is that the milk changes all year, mm-hmm. which is what makes the product so special on the one hand, because it changes in color and it changes in butter fat. But it's also something you're constantly tweaking depending on the cow's diet. So, for instance, in the summer and the fall when they're out on grass, the amount of butter fat goes down, which changes a lot about how I cool the cream and how I churn the cream. In the winter, when they're not on grass, they're eating dry hay, which makes the butter fat go up. So it's not exactly that brilliant golden color, but it's much more unctuous in your mouth. There's a lot higher butter fat. And that also changes how I culture the cream. So, you know, I kind of have it down now, but the more you know, the less you know. And there's always a surprise, which keeps it interesting.
It sure does. And you made a bold move to get the hands of your butter into a famous West Coast chef. So tell us about that.
Okay, well, another reason that I decided to make butter was that I was a bit of a foodie, as I think when you were here, we shared our love of all things gourmet.
That's right.
And so I had moved here a few years earlier from New York, and I sort of followed the restaurant scene there. And what was happening at that time, the whole farm-to-table thing was taking off, and artisan producers, as we discussed with Vermont cheeses, and farmers markets. And it was a very exciting time for restaurants and for small farmers, I think. And I had just finished reading a book called The Soul of the Chef by Michael Ruhlman. And he, half of the book was a biography or a discussion of the development of the restaurant, The French Laundry, which is in Yountville in Napa Valley, California. And at the time, the chef, Thomas Keller, had bought that restaurant from a couple who were retiring and had decided to kind of move it into this area of new cuisine, of melding traditional French cuisine with a kind of Chez Panisse California style of using local materials and handmade crafted foods. And so after I read this book, I thought, this is the guy who needs to get my butter. Because I knew that I wasn't going to make a lot of butter. When I started, I had three jerseys. So I knew that I wasn't going to be able to make it. Trying, you know, I couldn't sell a lot of butter, so I couldn't sell it for cheap, so it had to become a premium product. Mm-hmm. So I wrote him a letter, and this is a time when this was his only restaurant, so he was there, and I told him I was a small farmer in Vermont, which always has cachet if you're from Vermont, and that I was making this handmade butter from my jerseys, and would he try it? And he wrote me right back and said, of course, put it in a box and send it to me. So I did, and about 4 days later, when I came home, there was a message on my machine from him saying, please call me back. This is Thomas Keller. I almost fainted. And when I called him back, he said, you know, this is the most remarkable butter I've ever tasted. Yeah. Who are you, and how do you do this? And I said, chef, it's all my cows. I'm using Jersey cream. So, but anyway, he said, I will buy anything you make just every week. He didn't ask me how much I wanted for it or anything. He just said, put it in a box. I'll give you my FedEx number and send it to me. And so that began what is now a 20-year relationship with a really wonderful chef and a fantastic person. And as he's opened other restaurants, you know, he's asked, can you get a couple more cows? Can you get a couple more cows?
And beautifully, Thomas has even come to visit the cows.
He has. So I have a cow named Keller, and he was working on his one of his many cookbooks, which are beautiful sort of coffee table books with also beautiful recipes. And he had never been to Vermont, and he asked if he could come with his photographer, Deb Jones, who always does all the photography for his books, and meet Keller and spend a couple of days. And I always say yes to him. This is never negative. But I realized I was going to be cooking for the best chef in the world. So it was a little intimidating.
Oh, I bet.
Rick, I'll tell you that. But you know what? When you're a chef of that caliber, I was intimidated, but I realized, you know, the poor guy probably never gets to eat anything when he visits, you know, home-cooked
right.
meals. So I think he truly appreciated the effort that we made.
I love it. All right, before we leave butter, where can people get it locally?
Well, Right now I'm selling to Daedalus Market in Burlington.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's available there. And because I have so few supplies, that's at the moment the only place I'm selling it. It's all, you know, the pandemic kind of shut us down for a while or limited what we were doing as all the restaurants shut down that I sell to. So now we're just getting going again with the cows calving in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So right now things are a little bit slow, but I'm sure they'll pick up just like all the other businesses that have kind of gone through this shutdown period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Diane, you've created this much cherished butter and then you thought, I think I'll make perfume. How did that transition come about?
Well, some of it was that I had been doing the butter for so long, and dairy farming is a fairly rote profession. You know, you've got to get up at the same hours every day. You're in a routine. Your cows are in a routine. I felt like I needed some other joie de vivre in my life. So I guess for me, smell and taste are so connected. That the idea of creating artisan food, which is my butter, wasn't that far astray to creating artisan scent. You know, actually, I don't know if most people realize this, but smell, your sense of smell is responsible for 80% of taste and flavor, because you know your taste buds only taste the sweet, salty, bitter, sour, umami flavors, and the whole other rich area of flavor comes from olfaction, you know, breathing in, chewing that food, and retronasal olfaction, which happens in your mouth and gives what you're eating so much depth of flavor. So, and as we now know, especially in this time of COVID, when you have a impairment of smell, you also can't taste.
Right.
So for me, it was the love of taste and food was very connected to being captivated by smells. And it's a real creative outlet. I mean, when you decide to make a fragrance, you have to have an idea that you start with, and you have to be able to then translate that idea into smell, which is quite a challenge. And in a way, for me, it was like learning a new language, because even though most of us can recognize, I mean, you and I can recognize the same number of smells. I don't have a special ability to smell. But what's different about perfumers is that they can actually identify what they're smelling. They have a word to go with it, whereas if I have you eat an apple or a pear, I mean, you might know it was a crisp fruit, but you might not know the difference, or a lemon and grapefruit, or a lemon and a lime. And it's all those different things that it's like the smells are like the palette of colors, except that as children we learn to identify colors, and we don't really work on identifying exactly what a smell is when we smell it.
Yeah.
So just learning the language of smell and learning to identify and categorize and classify all the different smells in the world was really exciting to me. And I live in a place, I mean, farms are about as fragrant as it gets.
That's true.
Good and bad.
Right.
And that's also what makes perfumes beautiful. Traditionally, a lot of classical perfumes have very animalic smells in them that if you smell them alone, aren't so great. But when incorporated into something with flowers and woods or other things, are beautiful, make things, you know, just like spice in your cooking would.
Diane, I carefully choose the hand soaps I place in my bathroom, and I often get compliments, but that's a far cry from creating perfumes. So what is the process of learning how to do that?
Right. It's a real learning curve, and actually, Most people will tell you that to become a nose, which is someone who can make perfume well, takes a minimum of 10 years. So it takes that period to keep, I mean, when I talk about ingredients to make perfumes, a commercial perfumer, you know, working at a big flavor and fragrance corporation probably has 3,000 ingredients at their disposal, which include natural and synthetic ingredients. Mm-hmm. And I probably work with between 200 and 300. So that's a lot of things to memorize, classify, and be able to go to when you want to tweak your perfume one way or the other. So perfume is, the language of perfume is very much like the language of music, in the sense that we refer to the ingredients as notes. A piano might have 88 keys with which you make your composition, but as I said, in perfume you could have 3,000. So you can see it's a tremendous range and a lot to choose from.
Well, speaking of choose from, sent me things to smell this morning. They're called Pandora, Eve, Casablanca, First Cut, Gardener's Glove, and Frost. And would you like me to try to smell one of these right now?
Sure. Have you smelled them yet?
I have not. I tried to... Okay. Be surprised here. So is there something you think I should try first?
Well, how about trying Casablanca?
All right, good. It's got a nice brown, kind of beautiful brownish-red color to it.
Yes.
All right.
So that perfume was inspired one very brutal winter we had when it never stopped snowing here. I think it was late February. I looked out my window and I said, wow, I really need to be in a dark tropical garden. So I think I'll make that smell. So Casablanca is some very lush flowers and fruits and mandarin top notes. It has tuberose and orange blossom, but it has a dark kind of tropical base. What are you getting from it?
Well, I am in a rich, almost like library with the nice big leather chairs. And this is the smell I want in that room. I will, you know, and that's not necessarily my happy place, that room, but this smell creates that image for me. And if I have that room ever in my life, I want this scent in there with me.
Wafting through
there. Oh, my gosh. I'll be so relaxed, and I'll pour myself a single malt. And
perfect. That's a perfect accompaniment to that. That deep tuberose and kind of orangey mandarin top notes. And there is a lot of dark resinous amber smells at the bottom of that.
Yeah. Oh,
also, that's some gorgeous. Of those dirty smells we were talking about, which, you know, just gives it kind of a sexy undertone.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I know we could go on for days, but I really appreciate it. Our director, Danny, says, I was going to ask you what's next, but he says it should be scented butter.
I'll get to work on that.
All right. Oh, but keep doing what you're doing. It is amazing. So Diane St. Clair is the owner of Animal Farm and St. Clair Scents in Orwell, where she creates incredible butter and an amazing perfume. And you are amazing, Diane. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivrigan. And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference coming up after CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.